welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 10th of May 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and it's Real Britannia today, so that means that I am here with my co-host Max Musson to discuss the week's news. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's a bit muggy over here in my part of Britain. What's it like where you are?
Well, the sun seems to have dimmed a little bit, but we've had some good sunshine over the weekend, and so I would say I can't really complain. We've had intermittent showers as well, but I think that it's you can see summer starting to blossom, and so I'm looking forward to the rest of the year.
It is warming up, isn't it? It's almost T-shirt weather, but not quite yet. And we had elections last week, lots of elections. We had an election in Scotland, and the Scottish National Party won, as predicted. In Wales, we had an election, and the Labour Party won, as predicted. We had the mayoral elections, and Sadiq Khan won, as predicted, and we also had local elections. And in the local elections, normally the opposition party does very well. And I think for the first time in quite some decades, the opposition party did absolutely terribly. Labour did dreadfully in these local elections. And Keir Starmer stood up and said, I take responsibility for this. This is all my fault. And then predictably, he sacked Angela Rayner instead of stepping down himself. Some amazing hypocrisy that we saw there from Keir Starmer. And I think the reason why people don't want to support Labour is all this support of Black Lives Matter. They're talking about how they want to win back the white working class vote, and yet they're basically calling the white working class stupid for voting for the Conservatives. I think Labour Party really are now the party of the minorities, and we see that particularly in London, where we see Sadiq Khan, who has really made a total cock-up of being the mayor of London. Crime has just shot through the roof. Massive increases in knife crime, in murders, in rapes, in drug gangs, in shootings, and yet he is still voted in as the mayor of London with this absolutely dreadful record. And the only reason that can be is ethnic solidarity, because he is non-white, and because London is now 60% non-white, they are going to vote for him. David Curtin, the UKIP candidate, who is black, rather embarrassingly, Facebook removed his ability to post on the day that he was actually standing for mayor of London. I forget how well he did. I think he only got something like 1%, but this just shows you how much Facebook are now interfering with our elections. A major party candidate has had his ability to comment on the election withdrawn from him by Facebook, which is, you know, whichever way you look at it, that is election interference. That is censoring a politician. He is well known in London as a mayoral candidate. And I would like to have heard what he had to say. What really is the important thing about this, though, I think, is just the way that Labour have lost, and they have lost all the support from the white working class, which we saw in the last major election when the Red Wall came crumbling down, as they call it, and all these traditional places where people voted Labour ended up voting Conservative, and they thought that they were going to win some of these places back, and they didn't. One election in particular was the Hartlepool election, which Labour were expecting to win, and I think they lost that by 8,000 votes, and that was considered to be a really, really safe Labour seat, and yet they completely lost it. It's great to see Labour lose, but why have we not got another alternative to the Conservatives? The Conservatives are not conserving anything. All they conserve is the left-wing policies that the Labour government put in before they actually came into power. So it's good to see Labour losing, but not so good to see the Conservatives winning. Do you want to comment on the local elections, Max? Had any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that Keir Starmer started off on the wrong foot right from the very beginning, because he had his opportunity to become the leader of the Labour Party because of the campaign that there was against Jeremy Corbyn by various Jewish groups who were trumping up charges against Jeremy Corbyn to suggest and to convince the public that Jeremy Corbyn is anti-Semitic, which I think is patently ridiculous. But the when Keir Starmer became the leader of the Labour Party, he publicly stated that the measure of whether or not he had put things right, the measure of how well he was doing as leader, was going to be measured by the relationship that the Labour Party had with the Jewish groups that had been persecuting Jeremy Corbyn. And and so his declaration to the British public, stating the what his priority was going to be, his main priority was going to be to effectively pander to a small group of Jewish activists who comprise only a small proportion of the Jewish population of Britain anyway, and he wanted his success as leader to be measured by the relationship he had with this minute group of people. And so as far as the vast majority of the rest of the British people are concerned, the rest of the Jewish community and the bulk of the British people who constitute, 99.5% of the population of this country, those people were totally left out of Keir Starmer's expression as to what he was going to prioritise himself on. And so, from that point of view, he probably didn't do himself any good. What he's then tended to concentrate on is continual quibbling about the European Union, quibbling about Boris Johnson's spending on the refurbishments of his flat at Downing Street, as if that really is of any consequence to the nation. And so he's concentrated on issues which are of interest to politicos who live in a bubble in central London, but which have got no relevance to the vast majority of people who live outside that bubble. And as a consequence, he's been suffered a real drubbing at the polls. And it looks as if he's, although he's declared that he's going to take responsibility, it would appear that he's looking around for somebody else to blame for the poor performance of the Labour Party, and it looks as though Angela Rayner is the first one to suffer as a result of that. I think it's interesting that Andy Burnham, I think his name is the I think he's the mayor of
Manchester.
Manchester, that's right. And he seemed to do particularly well in the elections, or the Labour Party, the section of the Labour Party that supports him seems to have done better. And so it looks as if Keir Starmer has got a rival waiting in the wings for him to stumble once more, and so therefore perhaps be replaced. And I would imagine that all of the supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, who felt cheated as a result of the very unfair treatment of Jeremy Corbyn and his being drummed out of his position as leader of the Labour Party, all those people are probably going to have their knives out for Keir Starmer as well. And so, metaphorically speaking, Keir Starmer can, unless he's very lucky, is going to receive the same treatment that Julius Caesar had and have a knife in the back from Brutus.
Yeah, it's strange, really, if you think of the parallels with America, where you've got Donald Trump was taken down by Biden, and Biden is absolutely bland, and he's got, there's just nothing about him. He's got no platforms that are associated with his name, no policies or anything like that, and yet he managed to get elected. And I think Keir Starmer was thinking, well, I'm not Jeremy Corbyn. And that's good enough. I'm not Jeremy Corbyn, and everybody will like me because I'm not Jeremy Corbyn. But that's not good enough. He's got no policies. He's got no platforms. There's nothing about him. He's completely bland. He hasn't produced any meaningful opposition. As he was taken to task on, as we discussed last week, by the landlord of the Raven Pub in Bristol, he just hasn't provided any opposition. And also, I think that the Brexit thing comes into this as well. Because he spent the whole 2 years that we spent before we actually left the European Union fighting against Brexit and saying that he wanted to stay in the EU. And to then make him the leader of the opposition once we have left the EU, it's really sort of rewarding him for being on the losing side. And he's continued to be on that losing side. And the Labour voters that he lost, that the Labour Party lost, were all Labour voters that voted for Brexit. They all wanted to leave the European Union. So how is he going to appeal to Labour voters if he's still going to continue being a Remainer, which is really what he's done? And you brought up Andy Burnham there, and I was surprised to see that Andy Burnham actually got elected again, because the Greater Manchester Police are in dire straits at the moment. They're in under special measures, special investigation for being one of the worst police forces in the country. And that's down to Andy Burnham. So I was very surprised that he did actually get elected again. And what may have played into that was the way that he was trying to get Manchester more money for having a lockdown. If you remember, just before Christmas there, Manchester was being told that all the Mancunians were being told they had to stay in at home. And Andy Burnham was saying, well, we need more money. They need to be given more money in order to do that. It's not fair that everybody else has been given more money and the Mancunians haven't. So that may have played into it, that he was standing up for them there. And Labour actually didn't do too badly with the mayors, because they won the mayorship in Manchester. They also won the mayorship in Bristol. The reason for that was the same as in London. In Bristol, you've got a very, very sizable non-white population, and you've got a non-white incumbent mayor who was voted in again. And these mayoralties, they were all really invented by Tony Blair for these big cities. And I think that was really a way to give the ethnic minorities a say in things. Because once the city becomes majority non-white, they're going to vote for a non-white. So there was this position that was created with an influence, and that gave these ethnic minorities a say in politics. And I think when we were discussing Enoch Powell, and Enoch Powell had his prediction that there was going to be racial strife and there was going to be civil wars and there was going to be lots of violence. And I remember you saying at the time, Max, that they managed to avoid that. And one of the ways they managed to avoid that was through the democratic process. And Enoch Powell didn't foresee that just through the democratic process, when you had a large number of these ethnic minorities, they're going to be voting for other ethnic minorities. And I think this position of the mayor was put in place to try and diffuse that, because if you think of the whole country, they're only 15% of the whole country. They wouldn't get so many of them actually into the main government if it wasn't for the government having all these diversity policies and diversity agendas that they have. But in the cities where they are the majority, they didn't really have any representation. So there was this position of the mayor that was created. And now what we see is we have a black mayor of London who seems to think that London is completely separate to the rest of the country, and he should be having a say on foreign policy, and he should be having a say on us leaving the EU. I mean, he's vastly oversteps his bounds, and he wants to change all the representations of white people in the city and change them to representations of non-white people who look like himself. And we've got the same issue that's happening in Bristol with the mayor of Bristol, who supported the pulling down of the Edward Colston statue and also wants to replace representations of white people with non-white people. So all of this has come about through creating these position of mayor. And we also have a position of chief police commissioner, I think, and they also have quite a say in things. But we have yet to really see what these chief commissioners of the police, what they actually end up doing. So yeah, I was really surprised to see Andy Burnham win again after the Manchester Police had seen so much problems over the last year. So he must have managed to pull himself back through with this asking for more money for the Mancunians, I think. Well, what are your thoughts on the mayors that we now have, Max?
Well, I think that your sort of analysis there is that there's a lot to say for that. And I think that the same can also be said of these police commissioners. In times gone by, we didn't have police commissioners. What happened was that there was a career path for chief police officers, and everything and the suitability of a chief police officer for his job was determined by the police, by his peers, effectively. And what's happened with the creation of these police commissioners is that a situation has come about where, I mean, because these commissioners, they can sack and appoint the chief police officer in their area. And so it's introduced a level of political interference in the choice of the chief police officer. And so chief police officers are now not judged just purely on their performance. They're judged on their political correctness as well as their performance. And so and this is the main effect of having these police commissioners, that the police commissioners are people who represent political parties, and they therefore will then apply a political judgment as to whether or not the chief police officer in their area is doing the job correctly or not. And this again is another aspect of the progressive politicization of the public service and the civil service, and every aspect of public service in this country is now progressively becoming politicized. One of the other, just hopping back to something we were talking about earlier on with regard to Keir Starmer, and one of the reasons why Labour have done badly is that very often people don't vote for the political party. They vote for the person who is the leader of a political party, and whether or not they think that person is a nice person or whatever. And people quite often criticise Boris Johnson for the fact that his hair is all over the place, and for the fact that he seems like a bit of a Hooray Henry on occasions. But the fact of the matter is that he generally comes over as somebody who's not malevolent. Whereas just a short while back, as you mentioned, Keir Starmer had this incident with the landlord of the Raven pub in Bristol. And it was an incident where, although the press didn't sort of specifically comment on it, the press did publish the videos, which showed quite clearly that one of the men who was with Keir Starmer, who appeared to be one of Keir Starmer's bodyguards, did physically manhandle the landlord of the Raven pub to stop him from confronting Keir Starmer once Keir had gone into his pub, and kept the landlord pinned in the corner, and the landlord called out, "That's assault." And so it would appear that certainly in the eyes of the landlord, he was assaulted, and was assaulted on his own property by somebody who appeared to be there to protect Keir Starmer's physical person. And that wasn't a good look. That's something that probably did Keir Starmer and the Labour Party as a whole a tremendous amount of damage, because lots of people would have seen that. And the way it appeared was that the landlord was being bullied and being physically intimidated. And Keir Starmer, in my view, the only way he can deflect the ill feeling that will be coming his way as a result of it, the only way he can deflect that is by perhaps going to that pub and publicly apologising to that chap for the way in which he was treated.
I don't think we will see that, but that is the correct course of action. That is obviously what he should be doing. Just going back to the police commissioners there, I mean, what we really have with the police now is policy enforcers. So if you have a police commissioner and he's politically correct, and that's why he's been elected, is because he's been politically correct and the minority groups have voted for him, then he's going to be telling the police, well, you need to be concentrating on the hate crime policies, you need to be concentrating on policing people's speech and all the rest of it, and you could end up with parts of the country that have harsher speech laws than others. I mean, it's really become very, very politicised, policing has now, particularly in London with Sadiq Khan's hate crime unit. But I can see the same thing happening with these police commissioners. I mean, it's just to think that you have a position like that, which is really like a position in the army. You want somebody who's got there through hard work, who has been promoted because they're very good at their job. You don't want somebody that's there, but just because the majority of people have seen him on the television and think that they will vote, they would like to vote for him. You want somebody there that is very good at solving crimes, that's very good at going after criminals, not somebody that is good at getting people's votes. It just seems ridiculous to me to have a really important position like that at the head of law enforcement, and they're put into that position simply for pandering to the interests of the public, the people that they are supposed to be policing. It's very, very counterintuitive. Another subject that I wanted to get into is the Scottish election and the Scottish National Party and the fact that they have won again. They haven't won with an outright majority, but in coalition, I think it's with the Greens, then they have a majority, and they are pushing for another independence referendum. And this is all they will talk about. It's completely wrong of them to do this, because we were told at the last independence referendum that was a once in a generation thing. And then, of course, because we have actually left the EU, and they're saying, well, Scotland didn't want to leave the EU. Well, that's the same as saying, well, Bristol didn't want to leave the EU. Bristol wasn't asked if it wanted to leave the EU. It was the United Kingdom that was asked if it wanted to leave the EU, and Scotland is a part of the United Kingdom. So it's not up to Scotland whether they want to leave the EU or not. And it goes totally against what was said before, and what was guaranteed before, really, that they certainly wouldn't ask for another independence referendum for another generation. And now we have wee Jimmy Cranky over there trying to stir up trouble again and trying to split the country again. So what we have is, we have Michael Gove has been sent to Scotland to represent the union and to try to keep the country together. And then we've got Nicola, what's her name, who's trying to split the country apart. And on top of that, she's also been pushing these new, very, very left-wing social justice warrior laws there, the new hate speech law that they have in Scotland, which says that you can't even quote verses from the Bible within your own home, because that will be hate speech. And if anybody decides that they don't like what somebody else's opinion is, they can report them for hate speech, and they will get charged with a hate crime. And I was really hoping that because of that, they really weren't going to do so well. I just do not understand the Scots. I think they vote for the Scottish National Party because they think the Scottish National Party is going to do what is best for Scotland. And yet the Scottish National Party does not do what is best for Scotland, does not do what it is best for the Scottish people. It's intent on replacing as many of the Scottish people as it can. They want to make it an open sanctuary country for refugees. They want the country to be able to accept as many people in there as possible, which is the same as Plaid Cymru, in fact, in Wales. They want Wales to be a sanctuary country. Nobody's actually asked the Welsh people if they want to be flooded with refugees from all around the world. Nobody's asked the Scottish people if they want to be flooded with refugees from around the world. But thankfully, in Wales, the Welsh people haven't voted for Plaid Cymru in a majority. But in Scotland, they have voted for the Scottish National Party. It's like they are masochists. It's like they're suicidal voting for this party that just does them nothing but damage. I mean, their education system is failing there. Their healthcare is failing there. And all Nicola Sturgeon does is go on about independence. She just makes this independence thing central to absolutely everything. And I believe when you actually look at the polls, there isn't really that much support for it. When you look at the economy and you look at the amount of money that actually goes to Scotland from the rest of the UK, they wouldn't be able to handle it on their own. She wouldn't be able to just join the EU. There would be a number of years. They would have to find some way of producing their own money. They don't have their own bank. They rely upon London and the City of London to actually produce the banknotes in Scotland. Yes, they might have oil there, but we're supposed to be having this green revolution, and she's in coalition with the Green Party. So how are her coalition partners going to feel about having the whole of Scotland based upon an oil economy when they're talking about windmills and solar panels and all the rest of it? She's living in cloud cuckoo land. It's all just based on hatred of the English, which is really quite sad, I think, that Scotland is so hateful towards the English. I mean, we've gone into the history of that, and we've gone into the history of that from the English side when we did our series on Edward Longshanks. It does go back a long way, this idea that England should be ruling over Scotland. It goes right the way back to then. But we are welcome in England. We welcome the Scots into the Houses of Parliament. We've given them their own separate little government. We've had plenty of Scottish prime ministers. Gordon Brown was a Scottish prime minister. It's not like they don't actually have a say in what goes on in the United Kingdom, but they just seem to want to split the country up all the time. And I don't understand why the Scots vote for them. What do you think of the Scottish National Party's win up there, Max?
Well, I think that the majority of Scots people, as you say, they fall for the line that the Scottish National Party wants to do what is best for the Scottish people. But the Scottish National Party is in effect an arm of the European Union. The Scottish National Party didn't want us to leave the European Union. They wanted us to stay in because they felt that the plans that the European Union had for the United Kingdom were that the United Kingdom would be broken down into 12 regions. And you know, the same planning has been sort of in the pipeline for the countries that remain within the European Union. But as far as Britain was concerned, Northern Ireland was going to be a region as far as the European Union was concerned. I think Southern Ireland may have been composed of three regions, but you know, that's obviously outside the United Kingdom. But then Scotland was going to be a region, and Wales was going to be a region, and England was going to be divided up into nine separate regions. And once the United Kingdom had been broken down into those regions, and there was talk some years back of there being a regional assembly in each one of those regions, so that the identity of the regions would become much more localized, and that local people would recognize the that they were being governed insofar as those regions had political power, they would be governed in a way which is more in keeping with their kind of local personality. And effectively, that move on the part of the European Union, had it succeeded and had things gone along swimmingly, that would have created a situation where the entire United Kingdom would have been reduced into units that are so small that they don't have the size necessary to function effectively as an independent state. They would be too weak on their own to actually function as an independent state, and would therefore only be able to function as a region or statelet, in inverted commas, within a federal European Union. What happened was that during the early 2000s, there was quite a sort of an upswell of public opinion against our continued European Union membership. And we had the period during which the British National Party got two members elected to the European Parliament, and there were a number of UKIP members elected to the European Parliament. And so there was a first of all this groundswell of opinion which was anti-European Union had a voice, because all these people could be heard speaking in the European Parliament. But also the proportional representation system that was used for the election of members of the European Parliament enabled a significant number of people from from UKIP and also from the British National Party to get elected to quite prominent positions. You know, a member of the European Parliament is quite a prominent position. They're paid a very handsome salary, and they're given very handsome expenses. And so there was a danger that if Britain remained within the European Union, there was a danger that parties opposed to our membership of the European Union would continue to grow. And that they would tend to get more and more of their representatives elected to the European Parliament, where they would have an even larger and larger say, and where they would then be working together with similar political parties in France, similar political parties in Germany, who would all be voicing a criticism of the way in which the European Union was shaping up, but also where they would be representing the interests of their people. And so we would have the nationalistic British MEPs representing the genuine interests of the British people. We would have the nationalistic German MEPs representing the interests of the German people, and so on. I've often thought long and hard about why it was that the vote was taken for us to why the referendum was held on the continuation of British membership of the European Union. And I suspect that there was a little bit of chicanery that went on there, because it was an election where, surprisingly, a very large proportion of the mass media in this country, something like about six national daily newspapers, sided with the Get Britain Out campaign. I was very, very surprised when the results came in 2016 that a majority of the public had voted for us to leave the European Union. That was something I thought in our democratic system that would never happen, because too many people are swayed by the media. But the media were, a very large proportion of the media were hell-bent on swaying the public for us to vote to get out. Now, a consequence of us voting to leave the European Union is that, firstly, a route to political prominence is now denied nationalists within Britain. And so it's not surprising, therefore, that the vote for us to leave the European Union has also coincided with a complete collapse of right-wing and nationalistic parties in the polls, and that's because the job has now been done as far as the news media are concerned, and so they're no longer promoting the anti-EU cause, and because we've now reverted entirely to the first-past-the-post system, and so therefore it's very, very difficult for minority parties to gain any kind of a voice in a first-past-the-post system. So to a certain extent, as far as the New World Order is concerned, they have killed two birds with one stone. They've stopped nationalists from being able to get themselves elected to positions of prominence, and they've also stopped a lot of the criticisms of the European Union that have been emanating from the nationalists and the UKIP people that had been elected to the European Parliament.
That's a very good point that you're making there, Max, that it's new to the nationalist parties. And I think also what you were saying there at the beginning there about the SNP and with the region, that's why the Scots are voting for Scotland, because they think that it means that the Scottish National Party are going to be directly governing them, and it's more like direct democracy. And that was the appeal of this regionalism that you were talking about, splitting the country up into regions, and that would have been sold to the public as, well, it means that you are governing yourselves, a much smaller region, much more direct democracy. The people that are making the decisions that affect you are right there in that small area. But it's an illusion, because you don't actually have any power then. And these regions would never have any power. So the Scots are actually voting for the Scottish National Party, thinking that this Scottish party is going to do what's best for Scotland. But they don't do what's best for Scotland, and they don't actually have any power either, because they're just this small cog in the wheels of the machine, and they would much rather be actually joining the EU. So I think that really answers it for me.
But also what we're now seeing is that the UK is still, there's still this move to dismember the UK. And so whereas there was the move within the European Union to dismember the UK and reduce us down into 12 regions, now that we're out of the European Union, what we now have is the Scottish National Party wanting to have full independence from the United Kingdom. We've got the Welsh also applying now for full independence. And as part of the trade deal and the Brexit agreement with the European Union, we have agreed to put Ulster in a position where Ulster is not quite in and not quite out of the European Union. And so we've allowed the European Union to drive a wedge between Ulster and the United Kingdom. And so unless Boris Johnson and future British governments are very careful, we could end up in a situation where the UK might not be dismembered into 12 regions of the European Union, but we could end up in a situation where the UK is dismembered into four parts, and we could have a situation where Northern Ireland is increasingly in a de facto way dragged back into the European Union by virtue of the fact that it's got this half in, half out kind of situation at the moment, and where if the it may well be that England may continue and not be subdivided into nine regions, but we would have had the United Kingdom weakened massively by having Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland taken away from us.
What a dastardly plan, neutering all the nationalist parties and still splitting the country up as well. I mean, that is very devious of them. Yeah, that's very well worked out there, I think, Max. Shall we get into our greatest Britons then, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Rudyard Kipling. Joseph Rudyard Kipling is one of the greatest and most well-known poets and authors that Britain has ever produced. He was born in India, but taken back to England for schooling before military training and then went back to India. His father was upper class and he was groomed for a position in the Anglo-Indian bureaucracy, finding his first job as a journalist working for local newspapers. He was a voracious writer, constantly covered in ink, and where he spoke English but thought in Indian, his style was unique and often dealt with issues of identity and finding one's place in the world. After selling his first books and leaving his job in India, he decided to move to England, as London was the capital of the literary world. And he travelled across Asia and into America first, where he met Mark Twain, before then docking at Liverpool in October 1889. And that's a recap of what we were talking about last week. And one thing I also forgot to mention last week about his actual name, and I always used to think that it was Rudyard Kipling, and it is in actual fact Rudyard Kipling, and Rudyard Kipling comes from the name of the place where his parents met. It was a very romantic place. But the actual name Rudyard comes from the plant rue, which used to apparently grow there. Syrian rue, I think, is the long name of this plant. So Rudyard actually means a yard full of rue. So it is definitely R-U-E is how it is supposed to be spelled. Is there anything that you want to add to that recap, Max?
Well, it's very interesting what you're saying about the pronunciation of Kipling's first name. I think that other names that begin with R, U and D, such as Rudy and Rudolph, they're names that have that R, U, Ru pronunciation rather than the hard U, because nobody would call somebody who's called Rudolph Rudolph, and nobody would call somebody called Rudy Ruddy. And so it does make sense that Rudyard should be pronounced that way.
It must just have been when I was brought up, I used to call him Rudyard, I guess. So he docked at Liverpool in October 1889. When he got to London, Kipling had several stories accepted by the magazines, and he found a place to live for the next 2 years at Villiers Street near Charing Cross in a building subsequently named Kipling House. And he says, "Meantime, I had found me quarters in Villiers Street, Strand, which 46 years ago was primitive and passionate in its habits and population. My rooms were small, not over clean or well kept, but from my desk I could look out of my window through the fanlight of Gatti's Music Hall entrance across the street, almost onto its stage. The Charing Cross trains rumbled through my dreams on one side, the boom of the Strand on the other, while before my windows, Father Thames, under the shot tower, walked up and down with his traffic." Interesting description there of what London used to be like with the music hall. In the next 2 years, he published a novel, The Light That Failed, had a nervous breakdown and met an American writer and publishing agent, Walcott Ballastier, with whom he collaborated with on a novel, The Norlaka, a title which he uncharacteristically misspelt, and Norlaka is a place in India. In 1891, as advised by his doctors, Kipling took another sea voyage to South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and once again to India. He cut short his plans to spend Christmas with his family there when he heard of Ballastier's sudden death from typhoid fever and decided to return to London immediately. Before his return, he had used the telegram to propose to and be accepted by Walcott's sister, Caroline Starr Ballastier, called Carrie, whom he had met a year earlier and with whom he had apparently been having an intermittent romance. Meanwhile, late in 1891, a collection of his short stories on the British in India, Life's Handicap, was published in London. On 18th of January 1892, Carrie Ballastier and Rudyard Kipling married in London in the thick of an influenza epidemic, when the undertakers had run out of black horses and the dead had to be content with brown ones. And she was 29 years old and he was 26 years old when they got married. And that's quite a late time to get married, I think. Would you say that, Max, at that time?
Yes, I would have thought people would have got, well, certainly women would have been younger than that. Generally, if a woman was above 25 and unmarried in those days, she was in danger of being what they used to call left on the shelf. Men have in those days quite often would marry women that were perhaps 10 years younger than them. And so, from the relationship between their relative ages there, Kipling married slightly younger than would perhaps be the norm, and Carrie married slightly older than would be the norm. It's interesting that they were married in the thick of an influenza epidemic, which is quite sort of a topical aspect of all of this. And again, it just illustrates the way in which there were influenza epidemics that were quite severe, such that they have been remembered in history, and that the COVID-19 pandemic isn't such an unusual thing after all.
Yeah, I also find it interesting that what he really picks up on there is that they were, the undertakers had run out of black horses and they had to be content with brown ones. And I wonder how many horses they actually had at the time. I mean, we're told today we had to have our lockdown to avoid the NHS being overloaded. And back then they were worried that they would run out of black horses for the dead. And you think of the way that funerals are today. I mean, it's almost like a factory line. It's like a process. You're in there for half an hour and you're out and it's a crematorium. And back then it was a proper funeral that you had. And the horses had to be right and correct for it. It's just another part of our traditions that have gone by the wayside, I guess. They settled upon a honeymoon that took them first to the United States and then to Japan. But on arriving in Yokohama, they discovered that their bank, the New Oriental Banking Corporation, had failed. Taking this loss in their stride, they returned to the US back to Vermont, Carrie by this time pregnant with their first child, and rented a small cottage on a farm near Brattleboro for $10 a month. According to Kipling, "We furnished it with a simplicity that foreran the hire purchase system. We bought, second or third hand, a huge hot air stove which we installed in the cellar. We cut generous holes in our thin floors for its 8-inch tin pipes. Why we were not burned in our beds each week of the winter, I can never understand. And we were extraordinarily and self-centeredly content." Interesting there, contrast that with today, where people would use a hire purchase or buy things on tick or get a loan or what have you, and they've actually lost all their money and they're just going to buy second or third hand stuff. And he must have had an idea of engineering to work it out, put the stove in the cellar and have holes in the floor for the pipes, and obviously as the pipes were going up through the floor, they would warm the rooms in the cottage. In this house, which they called Bliss Cottage, their first child, Josephine, was born in 3 foot of snow on the night of the 29th of December, 1892. Her mother's birthday being the 31st and mine the 30th of the same month, we congratulated her on her sense of the fitness of things. So she was born on pretty much almost the same day as Rudyard was. It was also in this cottage that the first dawnings of the Jungle Books came to Kipling. The workroom in the Bliss cottage was 7 foot by 8, and from December to April, the snow lay level with its windowsill. It chanced that I had written a tale about Indian forestry work, which included a boy who had been brought up by wolves. In the stillness and suspense of the winter of 92, some memory of the Masonic lions of my childhood's magazine and a phrase in Haggard's Nadar the Lily combined with the echo of this tale. After blocking out the main idea in my head, the pen took charge, and I watched it begin to write stories about Mowgli and animals, which later grew into the two Jungle Books. With Josephine's arrival, Bliss Cottage was felt to be congested, so eventually the couple bought land, 10 acres worth, on a rocky hillside overlooking the Connecticut River, from Carrie's brother, B.T. Ballastier, and built their own house on it. Kipling named this Norlaka, in honour of Woolcott and their collaboration, and this time the name was spelt correctly. The house still stands on Kipling Road, 3 miles north of Brattleboro in Dumiston, Vermont, a big, secluded, dark green house with shingled roof and sides, which Kipling called his ship, and which brought him sunshine and a mind at ease. His seclusion in Vermont, combined with his healthy, sane, clean life, made Kipling both inventive and prolific. In a mere 4 years, he produced, along with the Jungle Books, a book of short stories, The Day's Work, a novel, Captain's Courageous, and a profusion of poetry, including the volume The Seven Seas. The collection of Barrack Room Ballads was issued in March 1892, first published individually for the most part in 1890, and contained his poems Mandalay and Gunga Din. So you've got quite a nice, idyllic life there in Vermont with snow in the winter, sunshine in the summer. He's got his nice wood stove there, and he's writing away, and the idea of the Jungle Book comes to him. Probably one of the most famous books. It does seem
a strangely attractive life that you had then.
Definitely, but also you think, well, you know, this is in America and in Vermont, and yet he's thinking about India and the jungle in India. And this boy Mowgli that's being brought up by animals, being brought up by the wolves. I can't really remember reading the Jungle Book. I can remember seeing the Disney movie. I remember I wasn't too keen on Kim. My favourite book was the Just So stories, and I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Did you have a favourite book by Kipling, Max?
Not book. I sound like a bit of a philistine when I tell people this, but I didn't like reading fiction when I was a boy. And in fact, up until I was around about 15 years of age, I could count the number of fiction books I'd actually read on the fingers of one hand and still have fingers to spare. But I used to listen to other people reading me stories. I have listened to the stories, but not read them myself.
Yeah, I was a bit the other way around. I used to love reading fiction and graphic novels, and I think once I got to about 30, I just started reading factual books. All I have now is textbooks and reference books. I don't have any fiction books at all. I'm just fascinated by life and history. Well, Gunga Din, let's have a look at Gunga Din, this poem that he wrote. Gunga Din is a rhyming narrative from the point of view of a British soldier in India. Its titular character is an Indian water carrier, a Bishti, who, after the narrator is wounded in battle, saves his life, only to be shot and killed. In the final 3 lines, the soldier regrets the abuse that he dealt out to Din and admits that Din is the better man. The poem was published as part of a set of martial poems called the Barrack Room Ballads. In contrast to Kipling's later poem, The White Man's Burden, Gunga Din is named after the Indian and portrays him as a heroic character who is not afraid to face danger on the battlefield as he tends to wounded men. The white soldiers who order Din around and beat him for not bringing the water fast enough are presented as being callous and shallow and ultimately inferior to him. So he's really sort of trying to teach people a lesson here, isn't he? And I think this gives us an idea of the mentality in the British Empire. You had to set a good example. You shouldn't be treating these natives badly. You have to, and some of them could be very brave and they could be very honourable. And you just have to, you know, keep an eye out for that and don't imagine that they're always going to be the same. The more I learn about these people from the British Empire, the more they appear to be completely different to the narrative that we have today. And this was in contrast to this other poem that he wrote, The White Man's Burden, which was obviously portraying the white man as you know, the higher of the peoples. And in this one, he's showing that Gunga Din is actually the better man than the British soldier. Do you want to comment on that at all, Max?
Well, just to say that prejudice is something which is frowned on nowadays. But whilst I think that there was a degree of prejudice in the thought processes of people, the people who created the empire, and also the thought process of those that didn't create the empire. But the point is that I think that prejudging a situation is just where you apply the experience of the past to the present situation in order to, as much as possible, to predict the outcome of the situation in which you find yourself. So I don't think that prejudice is something which should be as badly thought of as it is today. But what the experience of Kipling shows, and some of the other great Britons that we've had, Livingstone again, for example, is that they were people who whilst they may have applied a certain amount of prejudice in prejudging the situations and prejudging the people in whom they came into contact, they were also prepared to modify that prejudice and to recognise worth when the native peoples they had came to contact with showed that they were wrong.
I think a lot of the time today, it's actually post-Judas and it gets called pre-Judas. Yeah, and what we're actually talking about is, well, we have looked at these things, we've studied these things, we've looked at the statistics, and we're not talking about stereotypes here, but we're talking about pattern recognition. It's post-Judas, and yet it gets accused of being pre-Judas. It gets accused of being prejudice. We don't actually have that word in the English language, post-Judas, but I think we should have it. It's two words together, so I guess you can use it with a hyphen. Well, the writing life in Norlaka was occasionally interrupted by visitors, including his father, who visited soon after his retirement in 1893, and the British writer Arthur Conan Doyle, who brought his golf clubs, stayed for 2 days, and gave Kipling an extended golf lesson. Kipling seemed to take to golf, occasionally practicing with the local congregational minister and even playing with red painted balls when the ground was covered in snow. However, winter golf was not altogether a success because there were no limits to a drive. The ball might skid 2 miles down the long slope to the Connecticut River. Kipling loved the outdoors, not the least of whose marvels in Vermont was the turning of the leaves each fall. He described this moment in a letter. A little maple began it, flaming blood red of a sudden, where he stood against the dark green of a pine belt. Next morning there was an answering signal from the swamp where the sumacs grow. 3 days later the hillsides, as fast as the eye could range, were afire, and the roads paved with crimson and gold. Then a wet wind blew and ruined all the uniforms of that gorgeous army, and the oaks who had held themselves in reserve buckled on their dull and bronzed cuirasses and stood it out stiffly to the last blown leaf till nothing remained but pencil shadings of bare boughs, and one could see into the most private heart of the woods. That gives us an example of his descriptive powers there. In February 1896, Elsie Kipling was born, the couple's second daughter. But by this time, according to several biographers, their marital relationship was no longer light-hearted and spontaneous. Although they would always remain loyal to each other, they seemed now to have fallen into set roles. In a letter to a friend who had become engaged around this time, the 30-year-old Kipling offered this sombre counsel. Marriage principally taught the tougher virtues, such as humility, restraint, order, and forethought. So we can see there he's quite a sensible chap. He's looking at what he can learn from life all the time. How can he find some virtue in whatever he's doing and seeing it as a challenge? The Kiplings loved life in Vermont and might have lived out their lives there were it not for two incidents, one of global politics and the other of family discord. By the early 1890s, the United Kingdom and Venezuela were in a border dispute involving British Guiana. The US had made several offers to arbitrate, but in 1895, the new American Secretary of State, Richard Olney, upped the ante by arguing for the American right to arbitrate on grounds of sovereignty on the continent as an extension of the Monroe Doctrine. This raised hackles in Britain, and the situation grew into a major Anglo-American crisis with talk of war on both sides. So Britain was really thinking that America was getting too big for its boots at this time, but of course you're actually talking about that side of the world rather than over in Britain. And this Monroe Doctrine was the sort of right to rule, wasn't it? I think encouraging America to colonize places and set a good example, but because they could, because they had that power, and saying that that power was good and they were going to use it for good. Now, although the crisis eased into greater United States-British cooperation, Kipling was bewildered by what he felt was persistent anti-British sentiment in the United States, especially in the press. He wrote in a letter that it felt like being aimed at with a decanter across a friendly dinner table. By January 1896, he had decided to end his family's good, wholesome life in the United States and seek their fortunes elsewhere. A family dispute became the final straw. For some time, relations between Carrie and her brother, Beatty Ballastier, had been strained owing to his drinking and insolvency. And in May 1896, an inebriated Beatty encountered Kipling on the street and threatened him with physical harm. The incident led to Beatty's eventual arrest, but in the subsequent hearing and the resulting publicity, Kipling's privacy was destroyed, and he was left feeling miserable and exhausted. In July 1896, a week before the hearing was to resume, the Kiplings packed their belongings, left the United States, and returned to England. I find it interesting here that he's not liking the sort of jingoism that's being expressed against the British, because later on we'll hear of his own jingoism that was being expressed against the Germans. You got any comments you want to make on any of that, Max?
Well, only that I suppose it was only to be expected to a certain extent that somebody who was as patriotic as Kipling would find that where there were instances where the interests of the United States conflicted with the interests of the United Kingdom or Britain, the British Empire, that he would feel it, that his situation was difficult and perhaps even untenable.
He was actually the poet of the empire, the official poet of the empire. By September 1896, the Kiplings were in Torquay, Devon, on the southwestern coast of England, in a hillside home overlooking the English Channel. Although Kipling did not much care for his new house, whose design, he claimed, left its occupants feeling dispirited and gloomy, he managed to remain productive and socially active. He was by now a famous man, and in the previous two or three years had increasingly been making political pronouncements in his writings, as well as welcoming his first son John in August 1897. Kipling had begun work on two poems, Recessional in 1897 and The White Man's Burden in 1899, which were both to create controversy when published, regarded by some as anthems for the enlightened and duty-bound empire building, capturing the mood of the Victorian era. Others saw irony in the poems and warnings of the perils of empire. And we've got a quote from The White Man's Burden here. "Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed. Go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captives' need. To wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new-caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child." Now, I think we can see there that he's seeing both sides of it, isn't he? He's saying it's the very best of the white men that go out on these colonizing expeditions, And while the natives are in some sense a captive, it is the white people that are actually serving the natives' needs. It's the white man that is doing all that he can to help these people. And we can see here with this last line here where he says half devil and half child. You know, children are innocent and they require looking after and they require helping out. And that was the way that black people were seen, especially the slaves. They were seen as being innocents and being like children. And that even played into the racial science of the day, where they would say that black people don't have beards because they're an immature race. The white race has a beard because he's a mature race. And what we have here is a younger race. So they did look on them as innocent. But at the same time, because of the ultra violence and the sexuality that they saw, the orgies, the cannibalism, all these other depraved things that they saw amongst these natives, that he also sees them as half devil. So I think he's very thoughtful about this and understands the difference between the races and the burden basically that there is of being a white man is that you have to show virtue. You have to be the very best of the best because you can do that. And these other races may not be capable of that. And we have to set them a good example. You got any thoughts on the white man's burden, Max?
Well, there was a study done some time ago by an author called Corelli Barnett, who wrote a book about British Empire. I can't remember what the exact title was off the top of my head, but in that book, he effectively outlines that maintaining and administering the British Empire cost Britain as much as Britain made out of the empire. And so, you know, a lot of people nowadays, particularly those who are representing ethnic minorities or who are of a left-wing disposition, they like to claim that the British Empire sucked the wealth out of the empire. But Corelli Barnett would argue that that's not the case. And certainly the poetry of Kipling here would tend to indicate that he felt the same way, that the empire was as much an obligation placed upon the shoulders of white men as it was something which brought us booty or wealth.
And also brought wealth to the natives. And as we talked about in the David Livingstone one, it was the colonizing of Africa that actually put a stop to Africans selling other Africans as slaves. There was also foreboding in the poems and a sense that all could yet come to naught. And this is a quote from Recessional. Far called, our navies melt away. On dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget. And what he's talking about there is that empires always fall, and we have that throughout history. We have all these empires that fall, and nobody really knew why this happened. I go along with the theory that it's actually race mixing that brings about the end of these empires. But nobody has really, apart from that, has actually come up for a reason why these empires rise and they fall. But he was obviously looking back in history and thinking, well, eventually this British Empire is going to go. So he was praying that the British Empire was not going to go the same way as Nineveh and Tyre. And he's praying to the judge of the nations to spare Britain, basically. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
I'm just ready to say that for any administration to last indefinitely, or for any empire to last indefinitely, it needs to go through a process of constant renewal. And I think that one of the failings that most empires fall victim to sometime or another during their history is that they become too tradition bound to the point where they don't. They don't renew sufficiently in order for the empire builders to retain their vigor. What happens is that the empire builders eventually become corrupted in the process of trying to keep everything the same and trying to live entirely by tradition, and that you know that that is the main cause of the collapse of empires, in my view.
The cycle, what is it? Hard times create good men. Good men create soft times. Soft times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. And on it goes. In The White Man's Burden, Kipling encouraged American colonization and annexation of the Philippine Islands, a Pacific Ocean archipelago conquered in the three-month Spanish-American War of 1898. As a poet of imperialism, Kipling exhorts the American reader and listener to take up the enterprise of empire, yet warns about the personal costs faced, endured, and paid in building an empire. Nonetheless, American imperialists understood the phrase, the white man's burden, to justify imperial conquest as a mission of civilization that is ideologically related to the continental expansion philosophy of manifest destiny of the early 19th century. And that manifest destiny is what I was referring to earlier, tying in with the Monroe Doctrine, that there is this burden upon us that we have to share the civilization. We have to bring this civilization to these other races. Whether that is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, it is based upon a desire to be charitable, to be good, to be virtuous, to help those out who are less well off than you. It comes from a very noble feeling that we have as white men, which I don't see in these other races. These other races don't have that. And at the same time, they don't actually have that gift of being able to create civilization. And I guess it's fair enough of us to share the gifts of civilization with these other races, but we shouldn't actually share our civilization with them, if you see what I mean. We could share the medicines and the rest of it, but they should be staying in their own countries. Once we allow them to come into our countries, to come into our civilization, then that weakens our civilization, and eventually it could weaken it so much that there is no more civilization left, because the original people that built civilization, their genetics are no longer intact, because they've become blended with the genetics of people that never actually built their own original civilization, and then that civilization is going to fall apart. And I think that was really the mistake that was made. Instead of actually keeping to segregation, instead of keeping the races apart, we told them all that they were all equal, and it was nasty and mean to say that people shouldn't mix together, whereas not mixing together is just it's a natural instinct. And if it wasn't a natural instinct, then we wouldn't have the separate races that we do. The very fact that we do have different races shows that it is a natural instinct to keep the races apart, and an unnatural one to mix them together. It's like a fetish, and of course it's promoted all the time on the television, in the adverts and on the television programs, as a way to weaken us and as a way to strengthen our competitors. And obviously that's the way that I see it. Max, have you got any final thoughts on Rudyard Kipling that you'd like to say?
Well, just in terms of what I was saying a bit earlier on about the sort of renewal of the idea of empire, it is a natural thing for countries to want to extend their sphere of influence, and in extending their sphere of influence, if the other countries that they come into contact with have not achieved a sufficient level of civilization to actually be of use, or to be of the best use, then there is the inclination there to conquer those people and to uplift the level of civilization that you find there. In terms of renewal, you can, in my view, that there's an indication when an empire has reached its limits, and it's the point at which people are no longer prepared to fight for the empire and to expand the empire, become embarrassed by the need to impose our influence sometimes on people in situations where we know what's best, and it's ultimately going to be in their interest for them to benefit from the technology and the civilization that we can bring to them. And if you look back through the, there's a very famous hymn, which is "I Vow to Thee My Country." And if we have a look at that particular hymn, the I can't remember the name, I think it's Sir Cecil Spring Rice was the person who wrote the words, but he wrote three verses. And yet, if you look for the lyrics of that particular hymn, you'll find that there are almost everywhere only two verses that are reported. And if you manage to find the third verse is actually the second verse. So there are three verses, but the second verse is always missed out. And the second verse kind of fits very neatly with the kind of thoughts that Kipling probably would have had, and that the and the patriotism that he would have felt towards the British Empire. And and the third verse rings, "I heard my country calling away across the sea, across the wastes of waters she calls and calls to me. Her sword is girded at her side, her helmet on her head, and around her feet are lying the dying and the dead. I hear the noise of battle, the thunder of her guns. I haste to thee, my mother, a son among thy sons." And that's the kind of patriotism that Kipling would have felt, and obviously that's the author, Sir Cecil Spring Rice, felt at the time, and something which was sufficient, that kind of patriotism, to sustain the empire. But when people felt that embarrassed to sing those words, then that begins the process of crumbling and the loss of renewal, and that brings about then the loss of empire.
I think you got a good point there. When people are no longer prepared to die for it, and also it's our duty to do this, because if it's not us that are imposing law and order and all the traits of civilization, then who is going to do it? Somebody else is going to do it, and their idea of law and order may be very different to ours. You know, it's just so basic what should be going on. And instead of that, we've just allowed this crazy, unnatural idea of equality to take over. Well, let's leave that there then, Max, and we'll get on with some more of that next week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.